Welcome back to Unknown Artist. I'm your host, Nikki E. Taylor, and this is part three with Claire Porter. Developing that over your life?
When I was growing up, I was very lucky, and I got in a bunch of choirs. Mm-hmm. So, like, I was really, really shy when I was super little. Really super shy. Like, I had a stutter, and I couldn't talk to anyone. I remember the first competitive choir that I was in first grade, and I was friends with this girl, I think her name was like Amanda or Anastasia or something like that. She's Russian. And she really wanted to be in this choir because you got to travel with it. It was like, you know, competitive, whatever. So like I deliberately, because I knew that there's only a certain number of places for our age level in the choir, I deliberately did not audition. So I guess she went to audition. And then the teacher, who was a very mean person, decided to send her to get me. And then she made me audition in front of her. And then she was like, "Now you can see why Claire got the spot."
Oh, that is so cruel.
It was so mean. Grade one.
Oh my god.
Grade one. You know what I mean? Like, it was just, like, it was awful.
Who is this cruel, cruel teacher?
She was my music teacher for grade one, grade two, grade three, and she gave me a B every year in music because I didn't smile enough. And she said that children who don't smile aren't natural.
Oh my god.
Yeah, she was fucking evil.
Wow. That's so awful.
Mrs. Nolan. She's the worst.
I am so sorry.
That's all good. But yeah, like, with that choir, like, I got to travel around a bunch and, like, got to do these different things. And then because of that choir, they had, like, a bigger choir that was auditioned, and then they had a more competitive one, which was a chamber choir, which I was also a part of. Then I joined, like, a world music choir, which was really, really cool. And then after that, I did an audition for the Newfoundland Youth Symphony Choir, which was, like, really well-known. Which is still really well known, and they got me in on, like, a bursary, which was really, really cool, because it was quite expensive to be part of that choir, and, like, that's sort of where I got the vast majority of my music knowledge, was just from choirs, but, like, from the Newfoundland Youth, I got to do, like, free fiddle classes.
Oh, cool.
And they, like, did, like, you know, ear training, and, like, this, that, and the other thing, which was great. But yeah, That's where I got most of my education, was just choirs, and people being like, well, because it's funny, because my register is, like, pretty low for a girl, like a mezzo-soprano, so they always needed that tonality in the range. Like, if it's going to be a good choir, you need your mids as much as you need your highs and your lows, right? Mm-hmm. But when you're dealing with, like, little kids, you especially need a mid, you know, because otherwise it can be, like, way too shrill sounding. So they just needed me. So, like, even though, like, Mrs. Nolan did not like me, and frankly, the people in Newfoundland Youth Symphony Choir did not, I mean, whatever, like, there were moments that were funny, but even though, like, my personality didn't necessarily match up with what they were trying to do, like, they were very, like, native and, like, classy, whereas I've always had, like, more of a casual relationship to, like, music and creativity, and, like, I've never been a big fan of, like, putting up orders or preventing people from creating. Like, mm-hmm. frankly, I'm not a big fan of audition choirs in general. I don't think that's fair. You know, like, I feel like the voice is, like, your principal instrument, and I think anybody can sing if they want to put the effort in. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like, someone is sincerely there and they really want to do it. You know, you can find space for that person. It's not that hard. Like, especially if you know what you're doing. Do you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Like, I've always felt that it was kind of restricted and mean. Like, just idiot.
Do you feel like maybe that first audition might have shaped your opinion on this?
Oh my god, that was so mean. It was so mean. And then after that, she didn't want to be friends with me anymore, which sucked, because, like, I was new to town, right? And I really liked her. And then all of a sudden, like, I was like, this is what you're doing now. You know, it was a Catholic school. It was very rule-oriented. We had to wear uniforms. Like, it was very regimented. I did not have a choice, which was strange because I was a very shy child. You know, like, if I was doing a presentation in front of class, I would be the girl facing the chalkboard instead of facing the group, and I would make my best friend come up and hold my hand. That level shy. So, like, to be in that situation where, you know, like, yeah, absolutely, there's a genetic component to voice, but to be in a situation where all of a sudden, like, I'm getting solos and stuff, but, like, that wasn't my personality at all, right? Mm-hmm. And, like, I don't think that there's space to be egotistical about something like that. Like, it's just like, okay, cool, like, I love it, and I'd like to think that I'm relatively good at singing. But I just like it, and I like it when other people sing. And, like, you know, there's so many incredible vocalists who don't have technical training and who probably aren't technically amazing vocalists. But, I mean, like, they're still incredible. So, like, why do we have to put borders on that? And, like, why can't we just, like, use it like an instrument? You know, like, an orchestra is very comfortable being like, okay, like, this is an oboe, and, like, this is a violin. They're two very different tonalities and very different ranges. Mm-hmm. Like, why do we have to put, like, a weird line between who's good and who's not?
Yeah, I like that way of framing it, finding, like, each voice is kind of a different instrument and treating it that way. Because that is absolutely true. You have a unique body.
Yeah.
Everybody's unique, and you can train it as well. You can just stretch the muscles. I mean, like that really is what having. I mean, you know this. You're an incredible vocalist, but like that's what singing is. Like stretching out those muscles and like knowing how to use them appropriately. You know, but like how are you going to learn that unless people are encouraging you?
Yeah, it's all about practice and exposure. Like if you're doing it all the time, you're going to get better.
Mm-hmm.
Same with like anything, right? If you're never given the opportunity, you're never going to get better because you're never doing it.
Well, especially like, if people humiliate you.
Yeah.
Like, that's the cruelest thing to me. It's like people get made fun of for not being able to sing, you know? Like you and like it doesn't even apply the same way with like an actual instrument. Do you know what I mean? Like if you can't, you know, you get a French horn and like you're not good at it right away, keep practicing, you know, or like kids in piano lessons or whatever and they just can't figure it out. Well, it's not that big a deal, you know? You do for a year or two and then you drop out.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's going to make fun of you.
Whereas, like, your voice is also so integrally part of yourself, your body, who you are.
It's very intimate.
Yeah.
You know? And, like so I've met people who, you know, didn't necessarily have the biggest range, you know, who couldn't necessarily, like, didn't have the same power behind it. That's fine, but you can still sound, like, so intimate and beautiful. And, like, you know, like, if you find something that's, like, in a good key for you, then, like, sing away. Like, I'm down, you know? But, yeah, I'm not a big fan of snobbery in music.
Yeah, no, me neither. But yeah, like, I mean, some of my favorite vocalists, like Patti Smith, she has, like, not a technically trained voice at all.
No.
She has raw emotion and passion.
Yeah, and then she knows how to convey that. That's Connie songs, you know what I mean? Like, that's an intelligence, and that is practice, and that is knowing what you're doing. Like that's vocally. Vocalizing?
Yeah.
Vocalist? That's a vocalist. That's what that is.
Yeah.
You know? Like, oh God, like you can apply that to so many different people. Like one of my favorite examples of this is like Robbie Robertson. He's got, you know, sort of like a wispiness to his voice, for lack of a better word. You know, it's very soft and he's got like sort of like, you know, it's almost like he's whispering. But when he sings a love song, you feel it, you know? Like, I would much rather that than, you know, some person who has been in vocal lessons since the first grade and who can, you know, do incredible leaps but doesn't have any emotion behind it.
Exactly.
You know?
You need that emotional connection for other people to also engage emotionally with it.
Yeah.
You know?
That's what makes you like successful. You know, like in terms of communicating that emotion or like having that response or like creating something. I don't know. I find it very boring when someone is very well trained but doesn't know how to throw in behind it. Like,
oh yeah, that's probably one of my biggest pet peeves with vocalists. So when people are like trained, they're technically great, but there's nothing behind it.
Mm-hmm.
They seem kind of flippant towards the activity itself, and like it's almost offensive, you know.
It's boring, is what it is. Like, and it is true that I've met, you know, people who have a lot of education in other instruments who are also non-inspirational. You know, like I've been to shows or whatever where someone was like doing incredibly technical things on the guitar, but where there was no luminescence behind it, which is dull, right? Like it's not fun. So like, where's that artistry coming from? Why are we here? You know, other than you trying to make maximum of the money that you spend on lessons. You know?
Yeah, I think, like, an entertainer needs to be having fun themselves for everyone else to be having fun.
Yeah, you need to be, like, entertaining and projecting and teaching to a certain extent and inspiring and making other people feel like they're participating in the evening. You know, like, one of the first pieces of advice that I got when I started performing originals was that, you know, when someone comes up to you after a show and they said, well, you should have done X, Y, and Z, that means that they're feeling inspired.
Mm.
You know, like and you can't take that stuff personally. Like, if you're performing and it's like, oh, like, I wish you had done this song, or you should do this, or, you know, like, or something way out of left field, you know, it's because they want to do it, but they don't necessarily feel good about doing it themselves, so they're telling you to do it, so they can kind of live vicariously through the stage and through you, which is great, you know, like, if you... it means they're dangerously close to writing a poem. Like,
I like that, dangerously close to writing a poem.
Well, it's true, though. Like, you know, like, I've had people come to me being like, oh, I wish you were wearing a different outfit. And it's like, okay, so you wish you were on stage and wearing that outfit. Mm-hmm. Ultimately. That's what I'm hearing when I hear stuff like that. Which is great news. Because it doesn't necessarily mean that I was, like, missing something. But it's something that you can, like, keep in mind as well. Mm-hmm. But it's a good advice.
Yeah, I learned a long time ago that people will come up to you after shows, they will say things, and it has almost nothing to do with you.
Oh, whatsoever. And they all want to be your best friend after, too. It's like, oh no, like, I'm much more broken than like, strangers. I'm not sure if you want to ride this train, you know? Like,
yeah, that's something that I'm always kind of fascinated by, that, like, I'll do shows and I'll play all these songs that are like, I'm screaming into the mic, and it's like about heartache and heartbreak and like depressive whatever experiences, and then they'll still be like, let's be best friends, I want to know all about you.
Yeah.
Everything you do. I'm like, did you not hear all the, I kind of told you a lot.
Yeah.
And I'm surprised you heard it and you're still down.
It's incredible too how like certain songs will impact people. Like you know, I have this one friend who no longer lives in Montreal, but she was like very introverted and very quiet, and therefore like was not big on traveling, if that makes any sense, or like journeying, voyaging, for lack of a better word. Do you know what I mean? So, like, she was in this sort of strange, like, I don't even know the word. Like, she was just suspended in her life. Do you know what I mean? Because she had this partner who was, like, living in another country, and then she was, like, trying to figure out, like, how to move, but then, like, couldn't. So she was in this strange stasis where, like, she wanted to get a job, but then, like, didn't want to get a job, and then, like, needed to like organize a bunch of paperwork because she wasn't working, like it was sort of like easy to procrastinate on things and like, you know, getting this done and that done, the other thing done, and like blah blah blah.
Mm-hmm.
So like all of this is over now. Like she like got past all of it. She worked really hard, but like there was like a period of like 2 years where she was just very sort of in stasis, you know, like not knowing what to do next, but knowing where she wanted to be, but not knowing how to get there. And, like, all of that sort of tension of, like, being in a place that was, like, moderately comfortable but not where she wanted to be, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
Was not, like, satisfying to her, but it was comfortable enough that she didn't feel completely motivated to, like, put all of her energy towards changing everything. And I have a song that I wrote called Chicago. That's about a hitchhiking trip that I took from, like, Halifax to Chicago.
Whoa, that's a long trip.
It was nuts. It was, like, a crazy...
How long did that take you?
I mean, like, there were weird stops along the way. Do you know what I mean? Like, we were like, oh, let's spend a couple of days in Guelph type deal.
Oh, Guelph.
Yeah. Kingston was part of it. Toronto was a part of it. Montreal was a part of it. Fredericton was a part of it. You know, like, just sort of stopping, just hanging out with friends, whatever. Pardon me. But yeah, like, that was, like, a weird trip for me because... You know, I was not in school, and I didn't know what I was doing, and I didn't have any money. So my friend was basically like, hey, you want to go hitchhiking in Chicago? And I was like, all right.
Why not?
Yeah, why not, right? So, like, I went hitchhiking to Chicago. But, like, it's funny to me because, like, when I wrote the song afterwards, you know, it's really a song about, like, depression and, like, not knowing who you are, what you're doing, or anything like that. So, like, I found it really funny because she always told me that that was her favorite song that I had ever written, and she would always come to my shows. She was so supportive and so nice, but like that was one of her favorite songs. And it's funny to me because like my reaction to being in a weird stasis of like having an idea of where I wanted to be but like not knowing how to get there, like my reaction to that is like, why don't I just hitchhike to another country?
I like the drunken slur.
Yeah, it was, but her reaction to it was, like, knitting this incredibly ornate shawl.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah. Like, it was, like, it was Victorian lace. So, like, for those of you who don't know, Victorian lace has to be so fine that you can pull it through a wedding ring.
What?
Yeah, so you knit it, like the gauge of yarn is called cobweb,
mm-hmm.
because it is that fine, and you knit it on these incredibly fine needles, and after it's all washed and blocked and everything, like it ended up being like a couple meters by a couple meters. And this really intensely, like, incredibly talented artist, right? But, like, again, like she wanted to be, like, living, you know, like, and, like, that's how she was sort of, like, taking up her energy to try to create something positive
mm-hmm.
out of this, like, situation that she was in her life. So she's, like, she'd be at my show, like, knitting on this, like, incredibly beautiful shawl that, in the end, was so fine that you could pull it through a wedding ring. Like, that's what that is. Intense, right?
I'm just thinking, like, something that is a couple of meters by a couple of meters.
Yeah.
Fitting through a wedding ring.
Well, just, like, you can make, like Victorian lace, it has to be so fine, and you have to be able to pull it through. So even, like in the Victorian era, they would have, like, asylums with, like, anyone who had, like, reduced faculties. You know what I mean? So, like, we're talking anyone who, you know, had some sort of congenital thing, you know, to someone who was in an accident or someone who had, like, an emotional distress or anything like that, they would put them in these asylums, and the way that they paid the rent was by knitting these incredibly complex pieces of lace.
So weird.
It's really messed up, like, when you think about it, right? So, like, you just have these people, you know, sort of confined together, and, like now we have, like, delineations between things, right? So, like, someone
yeah.
who has, like, schizophrenia versus someone who was in, like, a horrible accident who had effectively, like, self-lobotomized themselves. You know what I mean? Like, those are two very different circumstances. Or someone who just congenitally, like, has a low IQ for whatever reason. Like, you put all those people in one room and treat them exactly the same.
A bit weird.
Well, it's not necessarily, like, I would say it wouldn't follow the protocol of most hospitals nowadays.
yeah, it's probably not going to be the most beneficial environment for each of those people.
Oh, for any of them. Because, like, it was, you know, sort of in this, like, you know, they would have to wear sort of matching outfits because it was institutionalized. So they would be, like, in sort of, like, hospital garb. Wake up in the morning, eat some gruel for breakfast, and then get to knitting till lunch, eat some gruel, get to knitting, you know,
oh
gruel, and then straight to bed. Like, it's like that was their existence, right? But it's hilarious to me because, like, in the same era, I'm sorry, I'm a textile nerd. I'm a giant nerd in general, but I'm also a textile nerd. In the same era, there was this thing called tatting, where you take these, like, you know, a lightly heavier gauge yarn, I would say, on average. And then you basically, like, I've never tatted myself. I can knit pretty well, but
that has a completely different meaning in my mind.
Tat. T-A-T-T.
Yeah, I'm thinking about tatting, like tattooing. What?
That would be
yeah.
sick. basically, you structure it, you have to pin it out, and you have these, like, very fine sticks at the end, and then you sort of, it's almost like a macrame, where you sort of knot it around itself, and then, you know, down, and then you pin it as you go, and then you have to starch the heck out of it. And that's how it maintains its sort of lace shape versus knitting, which sort of builds the shape into it. It's actually, like, much more functional and practical in terms of what it is, but also finer, right? Because it has to, like, pull through a wedding ring. So this tatting was, like, what the rich Victorian ladies would do, which was, like,
hilarious if you also think of the alternate meaning of tatting.
Mm-hmm. But more expensive in terms of the products that you're using, more expensive in terms of the tools that you're using, infinitely less practical, you know, like, much less useful when it comes to the end of it. And still, like, you have these two groups of people who are in stasis, right? Like, the mentally firm, as it were, and ladies who are prone to hysteria, being stuck, making two very different kinds of lace.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting.
That is interesting. It's like textiles is what you make when you're in between places.
Or, I mean, like, in general.
I work
in
a textiles factory. This is hilarious. I feel like I'm relating, so.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, it's interesting. But, I mean, it's interesting to me, too, that, like, Chicago is the song that she, like, cottoned on to as something that she really identified with, because it's like, it's so different. You know, initially I was like, really? Like, that's the song. And then I started thinking about it, and I was like, oh yeah, like, that's probably exactly how you're feeling. You know, like, it's interesting. And I'm super proud of her too. She's doing super well. But like she just had like a weird moment, you know, just like, oh God, you know, like, how do I figure this out? And it was admittedly complex. Like, immigration in general, I think, is complex. But,
oh yeah, very.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Chicago.
Right.
I'm not off track, begging for lead. My hunger now has grown loud. I need some green, something clean, and a grain of salt. Oh.
Chicago, it's overrated.
We lost it all. It's gone.
Oh my god, it was such a weird space. It was such a weird, like, I was homeless at the time. So it was really weird to sort of be kind of at the behest of everyone else and, like, to have nowhere to go in particular. So you're just sort of wandering around, which is, like, really not my personality at all. Like, I like to know where I'm going and what's happening next. Like, that's how I like it. You know, like, I like to have a plan and, like, to just sort of, like, not have that. You know what I mean? Like, I'm, like, that nerd who's, like, a straight-A student and who can go on a diatribe about Victoria Place. You know what I mean? Like, that's who
you
I
plan
am.
Plan and a backup plan.
Yeah! Like, I've always been, like, you know, resourceful and able to deal with things, and then to sort of, like, not have anything but the shirt on my back, but then also nothing necessarily to do in particular, was a really weird feeling, you know? Like, it's like, yeah, it was strange. It was very strange. So I was just completely, like, it felt like someone had just, like, blew up my brain. Like, I had no sense of who I was or what I was doing or who I was at all anymore, you know? But yeah, like, to fall into that, like, traveling punk community that was around in, like, the early 2000s is probably the best thing for me, I'm gonna guess. I was lucky, you know, like, I wasn't homeless for that long, I never got into drugs, never really got into prostitution, none of that stuff. So, like, it was really lucky on a lot of different levels. That doesn't mean it wasn't rough for what it was. So yeah, I had met my ex-boyfriend, and he didn't understand that I was living in Fredericton. So he somehow, like, got my mother's phone number and was, like, calling my mom's house asking after me. So my mother was like, Claire, there's a man calling. I didn't know who he was or what was going on. But we met, I guess, at a party or something. And he just, like, every couple of weeks would be like, is Claire there? And she'd be like, ah! And then hang up. Yeah, I was homeless, whatever, so I was in Halifax for a bit, like, crashing with some people, and, like, I ran into him again, and then we had, like, you know, some fun together, whatever, and so when I, like, started going on this trip, he, like, got up early the morning that I was leaving, and then came back, and he, like, gave me this, like, thick envelope, and I thought it was just, like, a big long letter, right, and he said, like, don't let me sleep, get out on the highway, so, like, we get out on the highway, there with my friend, and I opened the letter, and it was $100.
What?
Yeah.
It's way better.
I know, this dishwasher. It was $100, wrapped in a bunch of his old CDs, and he wrote on one of his old resumes, like, use this money to come back to me. So I burst into tears, like, aww. Burst into tears, and I, like, went all the way to Chicago. Ended up going straight from Chicago to Toronto, and I was, like, crashing at my friend's place. And I checked online to see how much a flight from Toronto to Halifax would cost, because, like, at that point, I had, like, no hitchhiking buddy, and it's, like, dangerous to go by yourself. And they were exactly $100 after taxes.
Perfect.
Isn't that crazy?
Do you think he, like, looked it up and was like, this is how much you actually need, or was it just, like, lucky?
I think that was how much money he had. It happened to work out, but it was still outrageously romantic.
So you used it and went back to see him?
Yeah. Well, we were together for like 2.5 years. Mm-hmm. But yeah, at the time I didn't have enough in me to be in love with someone else, you know? I was not capable of that. But then I went back and then I started staying with him and then I started feeling more sane, you know? And then, boom. Like, something about having a roof over your head and clean and shower makes you feel good.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it does. Did your mom know that you were homeless and like how? Because it sounds like you had a relationship with her
at the time. Yeah. She's nuts, and she's not a very nice person. So I mean, it's a very long story, but she had kind of colluded with a bunch of other people to put me into that circumstance to like teach me lessons on how a young lady behaves. And so she sort of thought that if she made sure that I didn't have a place to stay, then I would, like, do things like stop playing music or, like, stop going to punk shows. And then I, of course, went the opposite route.
Yeah, she was fueling the fire.
Yeah, well, I mean, like, that's the thing, right? It's like if you try to force someone to do something, you can't actually control it, they're going to react.
Yeah.
And so, like, I just did what I wanted, and then she was absolutely horrified. And then, like, years later, details come out where I find out that she was actually behind a lot of the circumstances that ended up with me being homeless. So, like, now I know. But it was basically, she was trying to do this, like, money laundering scheme. So she needed me to, like, live in Halifax so she could declare me as dependent. So she basically ruined my life in Fredericton so that I would move back there. So that she could declare me as a dependent, so that she would, like...
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, and it was only, like $12,000 a year that she would have gotten from it. But she's just that self-absorbed that, like, she thought that was worth it. So, that's hard, you know?
That is hard. Yeah, we don't get to choose our family.
Well, I mean, we're all, it's fine. You know, like, I'm good. Like, as I say, I got my bills on time. But, I mean, it's good to know that she's like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, that's definitely, like, forewarned is forearmed.
Yeah. Also, that you can handle that. And you wrote some good music out of that.
Yeah.
You had a very romantic gesture.
Mm-hmm. Oh, gosh, yeah. No, I think there's all kinds of things that, like, I mean, like, I have... A lot of that is my personality, where, like, if you push me into a corner, I'll fight back. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not really the type of person who, like, rolls over and, like, lets you kick me in the back.
Mm-hmm.
That's never been who I am. So I really don't understand why she thought that was going to work. Frankly.
You're also someone who is really resourceful and resilient. And you can kind of make a situation work to your benefit.
Yeah.
You know?
And it was, like, a huge learning experience as well. You know, like, I kind of got to see how I was when I was, like, dealing with it. Because, like, I had always sort of, like, my parents weren't happy or whatever. So, like, I spent most of my time doing volunteer work in my community and, like, you know, spending time. Like, I was the kid being like, can I have an extra credit project? And then, you know, like doing volunteer work or, like, hanging out at old folks' homes. And, like, I started a recycling program at my school. And I was, like, you know, like, helping people, like, immigrants learn English as another language. Set as a second language. It was data terminology, which we'll say as another.
Well, I mean, it's not necessarily the second.
That's the point.
Yeah.
Because oftentimes when people come to Canada, it's like their fifth language. So it's like to say second is so condescending.
To assume second.
To assume second. It's like, we only got the one, so therefore this must be your second one. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, like, I think most people in Canada who are, like, born and raised in Canada, I guess I shouldn't even say that because I have a very specific worldview and experience of being a Canadian where I lived in a very, like, homogenous, everyone is white and Anglo kind of place. And I think there are a lot of places like that, but that's certainly not everywhere. But I think it's a dominant sort of experience.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It depends upon where you're at, you know? Like my family was very insistent that I learn French. I'm very fluent in French right now, and I'm happy that I am. You know, like I used to be relatively fluent in Spanish because I lived in a Latin American country for a while as well. I would love to improve my Spanish again, you know, like get back to that. But like, I'd love to be trilingual there, you know, like it's fun. But I mean, like if you're in a space where people are encouraging you to do it, then you do it. If not, not, right?
You're a product of our environment.
Yeah, you know, but like it depends upon like how people are encouraging you and like what's around and this, that, and the other thing. But yeah, again, like I was always that nerd who like sort of sought out positive reinforcement in very specific ways. So to not have that around and to like have to find that project from within myself completely. Do you know what I mean? And like not have an adult there to be like, good job. Was interesting. Cause like before, at my third elementary school, I was like, we need a recycling program. So I like started a recycling program.
I'm not at all surprised.
But there was still like there was like a teacher who was like, good job, you know? Then I was like again, I did 9/10 of the work, but it was still like I got the pat on the head of like success, you know?
Yeah.
So like to work now without that feels more natural. So I'm kind of happy that I had that sort of like, you know, cold splash into like the horrors of adult living early, as opposed to like hitting that after university or whatever. Like I'm kind of happy that it happened that way, and like, yeah. So yeah.
Amazing. No complaints. Well, thank you for coming and for doing this.
All right.
And I look forward to the rest of the music. And this has been really nice. It's rare that, you know, I've seen you play, I've heard you play a lot, and I get general impressions, but it's often in loud environments, often with, like, lots of distractions. And it's really nice to just sit and actually re-listen to the lyrics and how you formed the music.
That's so sweet.
It's really great.
Thank you.
High
five.
Yeah. Well, that's it with Claire Porter. Check in with our next episode featuring Najee on Unknown Artist.